All right. Good morning, everyone. All right, I know it's pretty early, but appreciate everyone being here. My name is Jay Schmelzer. I'm one of the directors of program management and the Visual Studio team at Microsoft. Specifically, my team is responsible for the Common Language Runtime, the .NET Framework, the managed programming languages, so C#, Visual Basic .NET, F#, and then a number of experiences inside of Visual Studio, obviously the ones core to editing and debugging VB, C# and F# applications, but also the tools around building applications for the cloud, as well as applications that target Office and SharePoint and the new Office 365 APIs. This morning, what I thought we would do is spend the time talking about what's next for .NET. What are we planning to bring out in the next, release of Visual Studio? I'll touch deeper on some things than others. There's a number of sessions this week given by other members of the team that will go into a lot more detail. So I'll just try to give you a little bit broader picture of what we're doing. But don't worry, I'll try to do as many demos as possible just so that we can all stay awake this early in the morning and not be have a death by PowerPoint this early. So before we dive into the specifics, I thought it's interesting to just share with you a little bit of what the state of the .NET developer universe looks like today. At this point, we have actually over 1.8 billion machines that have actively installed and are actively taking updates to the .NET framework. This number is measured just by Windows Update, the Windows Update mechanism. So machines that are managed by a corporate IT department or sitting behind a firewall and are not available via Windows Update don't count in this number. So the number is actually, north of this or bigger than this. That's a huge install base that as .NET developers we can target with our applications. It's also a huge responsibility on behalf of the team to make sure that when we push updates out via Windows Update, we're not breaking your applications or those machines. And that is something we do take very seriously. The other interesting thing about .NET is that it's not just about a single form factor. And we'll look at that a little bit today in this presentation, but .NET has the ability, you have the ability as developers using .NET to target the smallest embedded devices, so supporting the new kind of wave of Internet of Things, all the way up through the massively scalable, massively scaled out machines available in the cloud, such as those G-series machines that Jason Zander talked about in Azure yesterday morning. And it doesn't just stop with an install base of machines or a target audience of machines that you can go to. Everybody has their own number for this. I picked a number that's kind of in the middle. But as far as the number of professional developers in the world that use .NET or develop applications with .NET, that number is around 6 million. So that's a big ecosystem, a big community of fellow developers that we can work with and all help each other be successful on this development platform. So hopefully what that represents for you is an opportunity. It's the opportunity of a number of devices, a number of install points that you can reach with your applications, and a community that you can engage with to help learn and build your skills going forward. So let's talk a little bit about what trends we see in the professional developer space and what motivates us and our design principles for the next versions of Visual Studio. When we go out and talk to folks, there are a number of key themes that come up, kind of distilled them down really into these four. And the first is all about the idea that the role of software in organizations is just increasingly becoming more important. There really are not any enterprises, any organizations that exist today that don't think about software as a core part of helping them drive their business. And those that don't are usually the ones that are going to be a little bit left behind as everyone else is realizing the opportunity that software can provide, enabling different ways to reach the end customer, different ways to interact with the products that you sell through gathering telemetry and gathering data off of how those products are used. Of course, to reach the potential here, especially when it comes to reaching consumers or even to support the consumerization of IT and the concept of bring your own device. We're increasingly hearing that professional developers are being asked to think about device strategies. How do we support targeting multiple different devices, both in the operating system and form factor? Those two things combined, I think, really translate to an exciting opportunity for developers because your role is becoming increasingly more important. But of course, it also means that the demands on your time, the expectations are ever increasing. You're being asked to do more, do it faster, do it more reliable, and do it on a lot of different platforms and operating systems. One way that we are seeing a lot of organizations, a lot of development organizations approach this is by thinking about how open source can play a strategic role in their application development process. Years ago, when I was talking to folks in large organizations, the open source conversation was often more of a, well, maybe. Maybe in the future we'll think about it. Now it's not as much of a doubt as much as it is a necessity, and it's a matter of how we're going to do it. What are the things that you want to get in place to be able to help facilitate successful open source incorporation into your software development process? And it's obviously a big change for us at Microsoft as well in how we build and how we think about building our software. And of course, all of these things put demands on those existing systems we have, the existing applications that have been running the business that we've been developing, that we've been supporting, and that we've been enhancing. It's actually interesting, a lot of ways the device aspect of this, the consumer reach through devices and those kinds of applications has put an additional new kind of strain on those existing systems that we've always built. To kind of think about it a little bit, if you think about just the travel industry or the airline industry, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, those systems that processed the passenger records, that dealt with seat assignments and boarding pass generation, they had a built-in throttling mechanism. And that mechanism was based on the number of employees the organization had manning the gate, manning the ticket counters, manning the phone when you, remember when you used to have to call to make an airline reservation? Those created a natural queuing system for the back end. The back end was never going to get more requests than they had terminals and employees actively responding to customer requests. The internet, the browser-based website revolution or introduction of that introduced a next wave. It upped the number of people that could potentially be hitting those back ends. But when those airlines, when these organizations started putting out mobile devices, allowing people to book flights, print boarding passes, change seat assignments from their phone, they all of a sudden saw this overnight 10x increase in the number of endpoints trying to hit their back-end systems. If they hadn't thought about how they were going to introduce a queuing mechanism, a throttling mechanism, or a way to protect that back-end, everything was just going to fall over. And let's face it, we know they didn't go in and just magically scale those back-ends that have been around for, you know, 60 years. They had to think about new ways to evolve and modernize those existing applications, support the needs of the business, support the needs of these new devices. So those are all things that go into how we think about, on my team, the priorities we need to in designing the next versions of .NET and the next versions of the Visual Studio tooling experience. It's those kinds of experiences, these kinds of trends that are motivating our work. So let's talk about what that really means for .NET. If you were in the foundational session yesterday, you may have seen you saw a slide very similar to this. If we think about kind of .NET today, it's one big, very feature-rich framework that you can build on. But it's the same framework whether you're building a client application or whether you're building a web application, a website or a service. You're using the same core framework. And actually, you're pulling in the same library sets for the most part. That multipurpose framework has been great. When we think about it, it was developed probably, I guess it's been almost, you know, 15 years ago, a little bit more than that now. And the needs of the time were very different than they are today. The kinds of devices just didn't exist. The kinds of scale in the web didn't exist. And we need to think about how we modernize that framework to continue to support the multi-purpose types of applications, whether they be, you know, desktop applications written in WPF, store applications written in XAML, or web applications using the latest MVC, you know, SignalR, those kinds of technologies. But we need to evolve that and take into account the needs and specialized needs of specific platform applications, platform capabilities. Specifically in the client application space, thinking about how we optimize the framework set to give you exactly what you need for a device application. One of the things we'll look at here in a minute is the introduction of native compilation for .NET for a specific set of scenarios, as well as ensuring that as we get into smaller and smaller devices, as we get into embedded devices, providing you the ability to have the smallest possible footprint while maintaining the level of productivity you expect from tools like C# and .NET. Also ensuring that you can be side by side with other applications so you can roll out the latest release of a framework or incorporate the latest release of the framework with your application and be confident that you're not going to affect adversely another application that's on that device. And of course, recognizing, as I look out in the audience and I see a lot of Apple logos staring at me, it's not just a Windows world anymore, and you need to be able to build for multiple different devices, and we want you to be able to do that with Visual Studio and with C# and .NET. And then you look at the web and the services and the cloud, and the requirements there are quite different. You're looking for high throughput. You're looking for high scalability. You still want a small footprint, or at least the operators of the cloud want small footprints. Azure wants a small footprint for an application, so we can put as many sites and services into compute resources as possible. You want the same for your data centers. But also thinking about how we enable cross-platform. You saw a lot of conversations, or you heard a lot of conversations yesterday morning in the keynote around container technologies and how we think about being able to deploy into those and work into those, and that's certainly something we're thinking about. And of course, continuing to invest in the core of the framework, the core of the runtime, through things like our next generation JIT that I'll show you a little bit of a demo of, additional libraries that we can put on top of that, as well as just the compiler technology itself. So through the Roslyn project, the new .NET compiler project, enabling just next generation experiences to be developed within the product and within Visual Studio. And of course, continuing to invest in the library stack, ensuring you have the best base class libraries and increasing our investment in the portable class library set, the PCL set, that allows you to go and use those same capabilities across multiple different devices and multiple different operating systems. And of course, doing it all with an eye towards open source and where possible starting in open source. I can't stress enough how much the concept of embracing open source is something that we're taking very, very seriously, and we're really trying to change the way we work. I'll admit, in the team, it's quite interesting to see the reaction of some of the developers that work on the Roslyn project, for example, that are used to code reviews of others in the team or a subset of people in the team whenever they put something in, check something in, and, you know, it's whatever. 20, 30 people are actively looking at and reviewing what a check-in is. Since Build, when we open sourced the Roslyn project and started working in the open source world, and now they're realizing they've got thousands of people potentially looking at every check-in they do. As a person that runs the team, I think that's great. They had a little less excitement about that, but I think they're all kind of learning to embrace it, and it's a really good thing. So we'll talk a little bit about more later as well. So let's start talking through each of these areas, and let's kind of walk through them a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about .NET Native. So this is the ability to ultimately use C# and .NET and get that productive experience that you're expecting and you're used to building applications, but at the end, have it compiled down to a native executable, specifically removing things like the JIT, removing NGen, right? Removing those things from the process. It's a native binary. It's a native image that we produce at the end. And we do it by hooking in the same back-end C++ compiler that you would use if you were building C++ in Visual Studio today. So it does a number of interesting things. One, it produces, you know, a native image, so you get faster startup times, you get smaller working set, because you're statically linking in only the parts of the framework that you use. It also means you get the same optimizations that the C++ developers have. So the optimization work that's gone into our C++ backend now applies to these developers as well. We have previews available. We've actually had them available since about build. You can go download it and explore it and play with it. We started out, our first target has been Windows 8.1 store applications. So if you're building a store application in C Sharp, you can use .NET Native and explore that. This is really sort of the next generation or evolution of our store compilation technology. You may not be aware of it, but if you have a Windows phone, the applications that come down, the .NET applications that people build, which is somewhere up north of 85%, 90% of the apps in the Windows phone store are .NET apps. Those have an intermediate compilation step that actually happens in the store. So you submit IL like you normally would. We put it through a little bit of an intermediate compilation step to get to a next level intermediate language to reduce the amount of just-in-time compilation and native image generation that has to happen on your phone to increase install time, decrease startup time, help your battery life, and so forth. This is the next generation of that. So we'll give you a tool set that as a developer you can use, but really what will happen is you'll submit your applications to the store, both as IL and native, but we will go recompile them into native in the store for you. We will recompile them to all of the architecture targets that we support, you know, x86, x64, those kinds of things, on your behalf so you don't have to do it. That's probably the biggest change that as a .NET developer you will see with .NET Native is you actually have to think a little bit like a C++ developer when it comes to compilation and build, because you have to tell us what processor architecture you're interested in because we're using the same C++ backend. But the end result is you will get, you know, the same kind of performance wins, same kind of performance characteristics that you see in native C++ apps when you're doing your .NET Native apps. Over here in the bottom left, I threw some numbers that you've probably already seen. If you're familiar with the game Wordament, we've been working with them. We worked with them for a few months before the build time frame, and they were one of the first internal adopters of .NET Native, and they took their existing code base, their existing C-sharp code base, as is, and were able to compile it with .NET Native and saw pretty dramatic startup and working set wins from just the compiler technology. We've kind of talked through most of this, but this is really the way we think about it, the idea of, you know, a lean and refactored runtime. Essentially now, if you were to look at the runtime for a .NET Native application, it's a single DLL, mrt.dll, amongst the team affectionately known as Mr. T, .dll. It's definitely less than 100K, I believe. It's quite small. All that's really in there is the garbage collector. Everything else has been taken out. The libraries have then been refactored to be optimized for that that runtime environment. And then, as you say, as compilation happens, the compilation, the build tool chain will go through and do, you know, remove everything from the frameworks that you're not using and static link in only what you need through a process that is referred to as tree shaking in the tool chain world. We just shake it until we drop off everything that you don't need. But you can still use a lot of the same productivity experiences that you have as a developer. You can still use reflection. You can still do those kinds of things. You just have to make sure that you help us understand how much metadata we need to carry around with your application so you can be successful doing that. So while we started with Wordament, in the Windows Store today, this is probably even a little bit outdated slide, but if you use any of these applications today, you are using an app that was compiled with .NET Native. So you will see a faster startup, you'll see those kinds of benefits. If you download the preview experience for Visual Studio 2013, this is kind of what your experience looks like. You go in, you open up your application, you right-click, you say enable for .NET Native, specify your processor target, and then continue on as usual. But again, the idea here is to develop your application just as you normally would, as a C-sharp .NET application. And then when you're ready to move into a testing phase and so forth, go and do these .NET Native compilations, test things out. We give you the local tool chain so you can debug in case anything is a little bit different. So let's take a look at the latest version of what that experience looks like. And so do that. I'll switch over to my demo laptop here. And so what I'm running here is the latest version of the next version of Visual Studio preview. It's out. You can download it. The same one you can use. And just to make things more exciting, I'm running it on the Windows 10 preview, because what's better than two previews running together, right, in front of an audience of hundreds of people? So what I've got here, let me just show you this little application that I've got. We'll kind of go in here and say, start without debugging, just so you can see the application. And it's just a simple kind of Windows Store application. Ignore that. That doesn't matter, right? But we can go through and we can look at different recipes and so forth. The actual application itself isn't really the interesting part here. What I'll do this time is let's go ahead and start with the debugger. Allow me to hit a breakpoint. I just hit an arbitrary breakpoint in the application. What we'll look at here is the modules window. And you'll notice that as I go through, you'll see that we've got a number of framework assemblies in there, right? They're all loaded into my process. They're all, a lot of them coming from the GAC, right? We got system.link, system.dll, all those things are just individual assemblies being loaded from disk into this process. Okay, let's go ahead and stop the application. And what we'll do is, let's kind of come over here, right click. You notice I don't have a enable.NET Native option. We removed that and streamlined it a little bit in the next version of Visual Studio. And instead, you'll see that over here in the build properties, I have this option to compile with .NET Native, with a .NET Native toolchain, but it's disabled. Why is it disabled? Well, we can't do it for any CPU. We have to go and specify the processor architecture. So once I say x64, that option is now available to me to go enable compilation with the .NET Native toolchain. Now this time, if we run, we're going to see a couple things. First, we should see that the build is going to take a little bit longer. It's going to take longer because we tacked in the tree shaking process and the C++ backend compiler at the end of it. So rather than the couple seconds that it takes to do a .NET incremental compilation, we have to go take the time it would take to do a C++ compilation. So again, that's why you don't necessarily want to do this as part of your iterative inner development loop. Just stick with MSIL as your approach in the C# compiler. But then when you're ready to go and do a deployment, or maybe as part of a nightly build process, go hook in this toolchain to push it out to your test environments. So we'll wait. We built in the opportunity to get coffee as a developer through the process. But eventually, there we go. So our applications come up. And this time, we're hitting our breakpoint again. And this time when we look at our modules window, if I scroll down, we see, skipped a bunch of them. You see, all of the framework components are now marked as embedded modules. So we've statically linked in the pieces that we needed from those components, right? We're not using separate, loading separate assemblies anymore. It's all part of your application package. Pretty cool? Yeah? Not impressed? Okay. That's fair. The other nice side effect of this is what it does is it gives you a little bit of a side-by-side capability. Because you statically linked in, you're not sharing those same library instances anymore with the other apps. So you get a little bit more safety of versioning for your application versus somebody else's application sitting next to you on your machine or on the target machine. All right, so we'll close that one. Switch back over here. Because that's just a little bit about .NET Native. As I say, there's a preview out now for Visual Studio 2013, or you can download the latest preview of the next version of Visual Studio where it's just incorporated in there. So let's continue down the client space and talk a little bit more about the way we think about the prioritization of and the things that we need to support. You heard in the keynote yesterday, Joe Belfiore talked about it. If you were in the foundation, Dev Foundation session with me yesterday morning, I talked a bit about this. One of the things that we are really excited about with the next generation of Windows is the concept of a universal Windows app. Now, this has a couple different implications, a couple things that it means. First, from a consumer's point of view, a user of a Windows device, it means that apps can have a single identity. Regardless of what device you're on, you can go to your store, you can acquire an app, let's say, the Link app, for example. And if you acquire that from your phone, and you then go to your Surface device, you will see that, hey, that app is there, and the one specifically targeted or tailored for that device. You go to your PC, the app is there and available. You don't have to go acquire it for every device explicitly that you have. It also means, though, from a developer standpoint, that at the core, we have a single common core across all the different Windows devices that are available, from small embedded devices up through, you know, Xbox and large conference room displays like the Perceptive Pixel display or device. So it means you can realize more opportunity to share code, share implementation across these applications. You can create applications that you use a single binary and work in a more adaptive way across the form factors. But realistically, what we see is more common is that you find that core logic that you can share across, and then you create the device-specific or form factor-specific views that are appropriate and give the experience you're looking for those devices. And of course, for the store applications, starting with the store applications, the .NET Native experience we just saw plays in there. And again, that's a starting point for .NET Native. We're not saying we're only going to do it for store apps. As a matter of fact, some of the first-party latest Windows Phone applications. So if you have a current Windows Phone, the calendar application is done with .NET Native as well. So again, same technology is starting to go and expand beyond just the store. But of course, we talked earlier about as developers, mobility is a top priority, is becoming a top priority for most development organizations. And mobility includes devices outside of just the Windows family. Turns out everybody doesn't have Windows phones. Who'd have thought that? Turns out everybody doesn't have Windows slates, as I stare at people taking pictures with iPads. And that's fine. That's great, right? I mean, we fully support and fully embrace the multi-device world. You saw it with the Office products, the release of the Office products for iPad. Turns out that those applications have been downloaded more than 35 million times from the Apple Store in just the short few months that they've been available. So it's great. It's great reach for folks. And we want you as .NET developers to be able to target these devices as well and take your skill sets as C# and .NET developers and apply them to building native iOS and Android applications. And we enable that through a great partnership we have with the folks at Xamarin, who have developed a set of technologies that allow you to do exactly that. You can write in C#, you can use a lot of the core .NET framework capabilities from the base class libraries and so forth, but have access to the native API sets on iOS and Android. They give you native projections in from those platforms into the C# language and allow you to write applications that way, staying in your familiar kind of experience. Okay, let's take a look at what this kind of looks like. And for those of you that were with me yesterday morning, hopefully we'll have a little bit better experience across the board today than we did yesterday. Now, so what I'm on, I'm over here now on a Mac, and I'm running Visual Studio inside, you know, in Parallels on my Mac. Now, I've got an application here that is built as a universal application. So you'll see, I apologize, it's a little small. You can see on the right, we've got a Windows Universal project that consists of a Windows 8.1 application, a Windows Phone application, and then some shared code. Then we have some Xamarin projects, specifically an Android and iOS project. And then we also have some multi-platform layers in here that are developed using the portable class library technology. So they're shared across the iOS, Android, Windows Phone, and Windows Store, or Windows 8.1 applications. And then the views are what's unique. So if I was to go in here and look at the shared code here, you'd see that we've got a lot of shared assets across the Windows devices. If I look at the model, right, for the portable side, you see that The model is shared across all devices. This application does a little bit of, it's a little newsreader application. It scrapes news from a very popular news source in the UK. So if you work for that news source, please don't sue me. No. But so let's take a look. So it shares a lot of this capability. Let's take a look at what these applications look like. So here I'm going to launch the Windows 8.1 application in the emulator. And you see it's got the Windows 8.1 feel, right? We can go, my Mac doesn't have touch, so I can't swipe it, but you get the idea. We can scroll across. We can go look at, you know, a specific article. We can drill in. We see the layout. And we see this feels like what a native Windows 8.1 application is supposed to feel like, right? It's got the same kind of navigation you expect. We got a little navigate back option here, and so forth. Okay, so if that's the native feel of the Windows application. If we switch and go look at the Windows Phone application and start this one in the emulator, yeah, I see you. There you go. Same application, right? Now it's skinned. It's got a view. It's got views that are just appropriate for that device. So when we go and kind of, you know, swipe over, we can now do what you'd expect from, if you have a Windows Phone. You know that's the common gesture, right, for moving between things. Is we'll swipe left and right. If we want to see more articles, we can swipe up and down. You know, when we go into a specific article, right, we see the article, but we don't see that back navigation, right? Because a Windows Phone device has, you know, a hardware button for back, right? So we can just use the back to move back, you know, from where we were back into the other parts of the application. So we're interacting with that native experience in those devices. Okay. Let's look at what that looks like on iOS. Let's start up. I get using the simulator. And now we'll see the application coming up on an iOS simulator, and it should feel like a native iOS application. So it's got the iOS app look and feel. This one takes a little bit longer to load in the emulator. There we go. But again, right, we can see that we've got, you know, the same kind of, we got the look and feel that you expect from your iOS app, right? You know, scroll up and read the articles. Again, we've got the navigation this time again is appearing because we don't have a device back button, so we hit the back button up here that we've implemented and move back into the different parts of the application. And of course, if we go switch to the Android device or the Android emulator, go start that. And we are told that, oops, I got the wrong configuration. Oh, well. We didn't even get to the fun part. I wasn't going to run that one anyway because it takes a long time. The Xamarin guys had a little fun with it too, and they put if you've used the Xamarin product, if you haven't used it before, what the Xamarin product will do when you go to debug with an Android emulator, it will pop up a dialog and says, these take a long time to load, are you sure you want to do this? But they have a new one. They've built their own emulator, which I haven't had a chance to look at myself, but I've heard is quite good. So that's just a little, you know, it seems like a fairly simple application. There's a lot of code in there because we're doing a lot of work to go read the news articles from the BBC's website, format them appropriately for the devices and so forth. In this case, if we go look at the solution architecture, and this I should be able to scale up a little bit. Let's go one more. Yeah, there's lots of lines connecting through lots of places, but in this case, that's good. What this shows is that we've got, down at the bottom, we have you know, a sort of a platform abstraction layer that is unique to each device. And at the top, we have the views that are potentially unique to each device. And then in the middle, where about 85% of the code for this application resides, is shared code across all those different application implementations. The fact that there's lots of lines pointing there from everywhere, that's just showing that they're all using it, as opposed to some like totally crazy, poorly coupled architecture or something like that, which I would never build something poorly architected. So anyhow, that's a little bit of kind of what that experience looks like, how we think about the ability and to realize sort of a not only universal Windows application, but also the ability to take some of those same concepts and apply them to the iOS and Android world when creating native applications using C#, .NET, and our partnership with Xamarin to accomplish that. Out of curiosity, show of hands, how many folks are building device applications today? How many are expecting to do so in the next year? There we go. How many are glad that maybe you don't have to learn Xcode and you're devs. You want to learn new stuff. I got it. That's cool. Okay, so let's keep going a little bit. One of the things, I'm going to jump down a little bit into the lower layer and talk about some of the things we're doing in the core, in the runtime space. One of the things that we've done is we've got a next-generation just-in-time compiler. Goes by the code name of Reugit. It's got previews available that you can go download. There's a couple things that are interesting for that. One aspect is interesting to me as the person who runs the team. We finally have a single code base for our JIT. A little dirty secret, our x64 JIT, our x86 JIT, our ARM JITs were all slightly different code bases, so that was not good. We're now off a single code base. What does that mean for you? It means we can actually now implement the stuff that you've been asking us to do for a long time. Things that the runtime could support, like SIMD, or single instruction, multiple data. This is, as you see in the picture, typically has been one of the top requests we get in user voice, because it truly is something that the runtime could do and only the runtime could do. If you're not familiar with SIMD, just a quick sort of visual of how to think about it. In the past, we always thought about increasing throughput, you know, decreasing or increasing execution capability for an application by going and spawning multiple threads, right, and getting into a multi-threaded situation. SIMD is a little bit the opposite of that. And it takes advantage of the ability to parallelize multiple data streams, but working off of a single kind of core thread of execution and letting the parallelization happen under the covers. So you as a developer aren't thinking about threads and stuff like that. You just think about a parallelizable data structure. Let me give you a little demo of what that, to help you kind of visualize what that could look like. So for this demo, let's pull this guy over here. Go on. Boom. Or not. You don't want to do that. Great. Make you bigger. So what we're going to do to show this, we're going to do let me start it. We're going to do a little Mandelbrot fly-through. So it's nice and visual, but also very, very, very data and processor intensive. So what we're doing is we're just doing straight, single kind of threaded, serialized calculations through this. And we're going to see this is probably going to take somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 seconds. The experience, if you know, imagine this was a game or something that you were authoring, you probably would not have the most successful game in terms of people wanting to play it. It's a little choppy and it's just not a great user experience. And we'll see, it's taking an even longer time today. A second here, it'll get to a point where it can go faster. I need to build a cancel in this app next time. because I think we get the point. You can do it. Oh, man. But it's slow. It's 1 o'clock in the morning for the laptop. It thinks it's supposed to be asleep. Here you go. You're almost there. This is the part that usually speeds up. Well, I guess that technically is sped up from what it was doing before, isn't it? All right. Here's what we're going to do. Yes. Okay. So, that one was excruciatingly painful, right? Normally I would go show you what it looks like multi-threaded, but that's still pretty painful. You guys want to trust me on that one? So what we'll do is this time we'll run it with an implementation of SIMD. In this case, I believe we're using SSA processor architecture set. So I'm running on a Intel dev laptop there. So I've got a couple different instruction sets available to me. So this is using one SIMD instruction set. It's decent. It's not the best one, but it's decent. And you'll see that it's going to go, and it's going to complete in, oh, looks like we'll end up in the about 30-second range, okay, 27 seconds. So still choppy, still a little slow, but wow, that's a lot better than what we saw last time, right? All right. We're going to restart the application. And this time, all we did was give it a runtime switch to use the other SIMD instruction set available on this machine. And you see, this one is significantly more performant. It's much smoother. I can't even walk away from the machine, and it's done. So, you know, a little over 7 seconds. Now, what does that actually look like? What is the code for that? You know, how would you interact with that? So first of all, here's sort of what, in running this through our labs, you can kind of see in this case, smaller is better. Just sort of the difference between the different instruction sets. So SSE versus AVX. Here's kind of how SIMD gets exposed to you. That last slide was not that. We kind of talked through it. But basically, what we've done is we've introduced a vector-based struct that has all of the common members that you'd expect. The interesting piece here is that the length is a fixed thing. And this is based on the instruction set available in your processor, right? So that's why we did that little trick with that application to change the JIT, because the JIT by itself, RyuJIT, will just determine, RyuJIT, the CLR, the .NET framework, will determine, based on the hardware you're on, what length to set that at. And in this case, it would always optimize for the best, so we would have always gotten that last one. We had to go kind of throw a switch in there to force the demo to get the SSE versus the AVX instruction set. So what does it look like in code? Well, here's sort of a very typical kind of looping mechanism, right, where we're going and we're getting an array of values, we're getting an increment, and then we're going and looping through and incrementing each value in the array, right, with that increment and just doing a loop. So this is the unvectorized part. When we take it into a SIMD approach, into a vectorized approach, your code now looks like this, right? We declare two vector floats, one to get the values and one to get the increment, and then we go and perform the addition as a single vector operation in your code that the runtime can then go and do this multiple data single instruction set approach to and get the kind of performance you saw in that demo. Does that make sense? We don't need to go and do the crazy hardcore. So that's an example of the kind of things that we continue to look at and figure out what are ways that we can go and expose simple, straightforward, but yet extremely powerful capabilities to you as a .NET developer. So obviously anything that's got heavy computation, anything that's graphics intensive, we see this being requested a lot in a number of medical scenarios where you're doing image processing and things like that. Again, it's you have to think a little bit differently about how you're going to structure your application, but you don't have to worry about threads and all these other kind of crazy things. It's just some simple vectoring. Okay, so that's a little bit. We kind of went down, the client app hit the bottom from one side. Let's go back again the other side and think about the web stack and think about the modern web. One of the things that this is really the set of principles we have going into the next version of ASP.NET. We want to make sure that to be able to meet the needs of the web and meet the needs of high scale services in the web, we needed a more modular framework. If you go into ASP.NET today, even simple Hello World brings in all of the framework, right? We wanted to make it more modular, allow you to pull in just what you want. You don't want our error page? Great. Swap it out. Or don't have one at all. We want to make sure that as you're developing the next generation of web applications, you have a seamless migration between on-premise deployments, hybrid cloud deployments, and public cloud deployments, so that your code can just flow between those, and you have the opportunity to realize the cloud scale opportunities, the cloud bursting, those kinds of things, without having to dramatically change the way you write and author your code. Part of the modularity, part of the way this works, is we wanted to implement and provide a faster development cycle, or a faster inner loop as a developer. Right, web developers, a lot of times, you're used to going out, and especially when you're doing markup-based changes, you can just fire up the browser, make a change, refresh the browser, and you see your changes happening. Want that to flow all the way through the experience, including when you're doing server-based code. We also want to dramatically simplify the process of building one of these web ASP.NET next-generation web applications. Today, if you were to try to build an ASP.NET application without Visual Studio, that's quite difficult. Right? Borderline impossible. We want to make it really straightforward for you to go and actually do your web development in the tool of your choice, and then put the burden on us in the Visual Studio team to figure out ways to make the Visual Studio experience just so much more productive that you still want to use Visual Studio to do those things. Of course, it needs to be fast. It needs to live up to the cloud scale. And of course, we also want it to be developed in the open. So ASP.NET vNext has been open source from the beginning. I believe they've already taken over 70 contributions from the open source community. So folks not on the ASP.NET team have contributed into that product. And that is really, really exciting to see. The kind of scenarios that we think about here, a lot of it is around enabling kind of and extending those line of business applications. So you think about that airline example I was giving you at the beginning, where you've got a back-end web application that maybe next thing you need is device applications. So you've gone from just a web-based application serving up pages to a web API, to exposing a web API to enable device interactions and so forth. We want to think about how you go and enable you to modernize that code base, transition from your existing stack into the more modern streamlined stack and technologies. And of course, we talked a lot about these common improvements. We've talked about this. The more control is one we didn't really touch on. It's important that while this is modular, while we are deploying these applications with the frameworks they need, app local, so you carry with you the framework libraries that you need for your application. They sit in an app local place for your website. You deploy another web application to that same server. It carries its version of those libraries. They sit separately. They're completely side by side. That's very important. It allows you to go as web application developers, use the latest frameworks you need to get your job done, but not have to go be shackled a little bit by the admins of the web servers that you're hosting on, and get them to upgrade to the latest version of framework and potentially have bad effects for other applications. You can go and confidently deploy. At the same time, we do still maintain the ability to go and service those common components. So we have the ability to go recognize when there's a library component that needs an update, needs a zero-day patch. We can make those available. We can give you mechanisms to go and ensure you've patched all the applications on your server farms and have the latest code working on them. The performance aspects of this, it's motivated by two facts that I mentioned this morning. It's motivated by the hosting people. So Azure themselves, our hosting partners, the internal data center folks that want to be able to put more ASP.NET applications on a single, on less hardware. It also means great things for us as developers because our applications become smaller, they become faster, they become much more responsive. And we talked about that. Again, this is something where I want to stress that neither what we're doing for the device or the client-optimized versions or the cloud-optimized versions, it's not like this is a whole new, you know, separate version of the framework. We didn't go and take the full framework and put it on the side and create a brand new thing. This is an evolution from where they are. They work well together. The modernization is a core, application modernization is a core strategy here. So if you look, what this chart is trying to show is a lot of the core capabilities, the core benefits we talk about from ASP.NET vNext are available on the full framework, which is what's represented by the .NET vNext column, or the cloud-optimized version, which is the full side-by-side, stuff like that. That's where you see the smaller, those last two things, the full side-by-side and the faster startup. So let's take just a quick look at a little bit of what this experience for the next version of ASP.NET looks like. To do that, we'll start a new version of Visual Studio. Create a new project, go into web. First thing you see is we have some new ASP.NET vNext templates just to help. This is not a final experience design, but in this case, it's just an easy way for us to help you decide which column in that chart did you want to start with. A couple things you'll notice right away. First of all, that project created a lot faster than the ASP.NET projects create today because we're not pulling in everything. We're only pulling in a subset of things. You'll notice in the project that the references have been completely reworked. So rather than individual assembly references showing up, this is now a package-based reference system, right? So you can pull in essentially NuGet packages, and they show up, and you can manage them as packages inside of the Visual Studio experience. And if you look at what some of these are, like let's say the MVC one, you see that it's a package of packages, right? There's the composability, the granularity here is pretty great. If we were able to go and plug things in and out, you can plug these packages in. If you don't like ours and there's another one in the ecosystem you like, great, swap it out. Not a problem at all. Let's go try to not make everybody seasick. Another big thing that's changed here is the project file. Gone is the big, crazy, hard to understand with lots of GUIDs XML project file. Instead, what we have is just a simple JSON file that describes the application. This is also where your packages exist. So if you wanted to go, you know, if you're more of a text editor kind of person, you could go in here and you could start adding packages, right, just right into your project.json file. The last thing I'll show you here a little bit is just sort of the way this dynamicness and composability and dynamic injection actually happens. Here's our startup.cs, where what we're doing here is pulling in the services we want, right? So if you don't want Entity Framework, great. You know, you don't have to pull in the package. You don't have to inject it into the application. You want to pull in new things, you can go and just add them in. In this case, I think later this week, I don't know which day it is, Scott Hunter, who runs this team, will be doing some in-depth demos on this. If he does what he normally does, he will show you from the bare, all you have is a listener, right? And you start adding your way up. In this case, we've tried to optimize the Visual Studio experience a little bit for the most common things. So you get MVC, you get Entity Framework, you get those kinds of things. But again, it's all composable. You are in control. You decide what you want. You bring in only what you want, only when you need it. So again, even down here, like things like static files, if you don't want static file support, fine. You can take that out. That's your choice now. Not something that was your choice in earlier versions of ASP.NET. The other thing we'll do here is let me just run this real quick, and we'll do it without debugging. So we'll kind of control F5 it. The other thing that we take advantage of is the next version of ASP.NET uses the new Roslyn compilers as its compiler technology. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, if I go into the About page, you'll see that we're going to go and we're going to bring up a page. And I apologize, my laptop's a little slow today. If I switch back over to Visual Studio and I go into the controller, right, and if I go into that home controller, you'll see that the message here is this is code, right? This isn't markup. This is actually code. So changed. So, changed it. I'm going to just save it, switch back over to our Internet Explorer instance, refresh it, and we'll see that the ASP.NET vNext kind of core runtime has detected that file changed, that it was a C#, that is a file with code in it, it needs to be recompiled, ran it through the compiler, and gave us back the output. Another way to visualize this, if I go back over here to the project and I say, hey, let's go look at the solution, the folder in File Explorer. Let's go into bin. Oops. No, really, let's go into bin. Debug. There's nothing there. Because we're using Roslyn, one of the things the Roslyn compiler allows us to do is in-memory compilation. Turns out, saving an assembly to disk takes time. Why spend that time? Let's just hold it in memory. So in this case, we're doing dynamic compilation of pages of classes of code as we need it, as it's pulled in from the compiler, to give you a more iterative experience. This is what actually would allow you to just do ASP.NET development with Notepad if you wanted now, because you just save the file and the web server process will pick it up and recompile it. Now, of course, you can still do explicit build steps. You can still have pre-compiled builds. You can still do all of those things. As part of your continuous integration, continuous delivery flow. This is really about improving that developer inner loop. It also makes it a little bit more realistic for us to take this to other places, and I think that's something that you'll see Scott Hunter later this week. If you're into ASP.NET development, I highly encourage you to go to his future talk where he'll dive into a lot of details and show you some of the cool things that can be done with these capabilities. All right, so that's a little bit about the next version of ASP.NET. Next thing I want to touch on very briefly is kind of the other aspect of things that we're seeing really starting to happen, and that is the idea of building applications that consist of a lot of existing services. You're pulling in services as part of your application. One of the things we've been working on is sort of a set of client library technologies that make it easier to consume these RESTful services. I mean, they're RESTful services, they're pretty straightforward to consume, but it is nice to have either just a convenience layer or in some cases even a pattern that is familiar as a .NET developer to access them. So just yesterday we released a new set of .NET client libraries specifically supporting Azure Active Directory, the Office 365 API services that were announced in GA yesterday, so specifically the ability to interact with mail, calendar, and contact information from Exchange, as well as files from SharePoint and OneDrive for Business. We've had Azure Mobile Services as a capability, so you could build mobile backends hosted in Azure Mobile Services in .NET. We did that earlier in the spring. And then going forward, we'll be incorporating a set of libraries from the Application Insights or analytics technology we have that allows you to get more data based on your application also as libraries for .NET developers. The idea of this slide is that not that you can read that code. The idea of the slide is to show you the difference between using the service directly and using the client library, right? Probably about half the amount of code that you have to write to go and do this. We just take care of some things for you. The other thing we try to do is make the simple things or things that should be common and simple. So setting up authentication, making calls to these APIs using things that you would expect, using the ability to do, you know, take advantage of async in the language, taking advantage of link, those kinds of things that you come to know and expect as a .NET developer. When you're in Visual Studio, we've introduced a new connected service experience. So you can sit in any kind of project, a WPF application, a MVC application, a phone application, what have you. Right-click, say Add Connected Service, and we'll bring a curated set of services to you that you can choose from, including the ability to configure them. So in this case, when we use the Office APIs, you need to declare your intent. So we need to ask what permissions we need. Do you need read access, write access? You just specify those things. We take care of ensuring that's hooked up as part of the OAuth flow. One of the other things we do as part of this, especially for the Office 365 APIs, is ensure that your application is registered with the Azure AD so that you can be a trusted application, show up in those My Apps pages in the Office 365 experience. So let's switch over and take a quick look at, we're actually not going to look at the Visual Studio experience this time. What we're going to look at instead is, we can stop that. Let's go to dev.office.com. And when we get into the documentation area, you see we have the platform, we have the REST APIs. If we look at the REST APIs, let's go look at the get mail messages. You see that one of the things we're doing is starting with the set of Office 365 APIs, we're investing in our service documentation. So it's making it easier for you to find what it is you care about as a developer, right? What is the sample request? You know, first thing, certain things we can try it out right here inside the browser page and we can get a sample response back. When we get further into that one didn't come back. So looking at being able to look at this kind of information, right, and see it just right from within your browser instance. If we go, another neat thing we've done is introduce what we call the API sandbox. So what this is going to allow you to do is right from the browser, without signing up for any kind of Office 365 developer account or anything like that, immediately start exploring these APIs and working with them a little bit. So this is an editor experience, right? I can go in here, and if I don't want the inbox and I want sent items, I can get sent items. This is based on the same browser-based editing experience we have in Visual Studio Online. So I have a bit of a rich experience here. I have a bit of a statement completion and IntelliSense capabilities right from within this browser-based experience. Today, it's JavaScript-based. In the future, we'll have C# support for this as well, so it'll apply for us as .NET developers, too. Okay, just a little something I wanted to show you guys real quick. I'm going to move on to the next chunk. The last big thing I want to chat about is the new .NET compiler, or what we all affectionately refer to as Project Roslyn. Roslyn is a re-implementation of the VB and C# compilers. For the language and compiler geeks, the really interesting thing is that the VB compiler is written in VB and the C# compiler is written in C#. Very important milestone for languages when you can say your compiler built your compiler. For everybody else, the interesting thing here is what we've done is we focused on transitioning from a black box of information, an intimate knowledge of your application, into an open API surface that allows us, allows other tool authors, allows yourselves to author experiences to increase developer productivity based on the knowledge of what someone's trying to do in their application. So it provides rich IDE experiences, it provides better analytics capabilities. There's a couple aspects of this. One, we open sourced it back at the Build conference, so there's a few things that we've done. For the set of folks that are interested in language advancements, you can actually participate with us now in language design and be part of the discussion. Look at the backlog. If you want to, you can pick off a language feature that we haven't gotten to yet that's part of the release strategy, implement it and submit it back as a pull request. For tool vendors, This means the ability to go in and interact with the workspace API layer and see, share our compiler symbols, not have to implement your own parsers, those kinds of things, to get that rich, intimate knowledge of the code base and create extensive new experiences. As application developers, it just means our life gets better. We have better tools. We have a richer experience when we're building our C# applications, our VB applications, right within the development environment. So let's take a look at a little demo of that. For that, I'm going to switch back over here, only because... So, sorry, I'm switching to the Mac, but I'm then going to go do a... Actually, what I want to do first, let me show you this over here. So for fun, I needed something. I went to the team and said, hey, I need a kind of a large code base that I can work with for the IDE demo. So they said, sure, I've got one. One of the guys, he claims, on a flight from Redmond to, I think, Amsterdam, decided he would write an NZEG game parser and engine, right? So what this will do, if you remember the game Zork, this will allow us to go and play, right, these sort of choose-your-own-adventure games, right? So we can kind of go and say, oh, okay, North of the House, whatever. So we can go and just keep playing this game. He went one step further and did the total developer thing. So, well, we could play it, or we could just run a script that plays the game with a perfect score. So that's what this little app does. Now, the app is, it doesn't matter, right? The app isn't important. What's important is I've got here a pretty large code base that consists of some C# code, some Visual Basic code, and some F# code. Now, I was going through here earlier, and I was looking at, you know, what he did. And aside from the fact that he clearly doesn't like to write comments when he's on an airplane, he it's pretty well structured until you get, you know, into maybe this area right here, right? That's not great. Now let me switch to this other machine where I apologize, I had a demo failure. So this is a virtual machine running in Windows Azure with the latest version of Visual Studio on it. So the only reason I'm coming from the Mac is the Mac happens to have a better Wi-Fi connection, and I didn't trust you guys. So when we look at this code, one of the things we see here is that... Oh, shoot. That's a bummer. Hold up. It's fixed. Well... Okay, what we're going to do is, the code before, you noticed he had a bad habit where he took advantage of the fact that you can do if and else if statements in C# that are single line without brackets, right? And the way he structured it was actually a little bit misleading what the code was going to do. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just remove that, or an example of that. And we'll come down here, move that one. To show you, okay, but now this totally compiles, right? But let's say as a development team, we have a coding practice that says, nope, we don't like that. We want you to always be explicit. So what we could do is we could go in and using Roslyn and the compiler APIs, we could create our own little extension. We'll call it stylish code. So this is going to cause the IDE to restart. Yeah, save that. Restart it. No. Okay. Go on. No. No. Not gonna work. That's a bummer. Of course. Well, let's do this one last time. No, don't try to take it out. Yes, keep going. Hey, look at that. Okay. So let's try to do this real quick. Oops, not there, there. Clear all async. Real quick. Are you in there? All right, let me, well, that's not gonna work. Apparently, the Roslyn preview has died, because we just turned into a text editor. Anyway, what you would have seen is we had a custom utility that would flag for me the places where we weren't following our coding style guidelines. We'd put a little light bulb over in the tray, a little squiggle underneath it. When I hover over it, it would actually show me, hey, you should fix it like this. Do you want me to fix it? And it would just apply those changes for me right within the IDE. Again, later this week, Kevin from the team is going to be doing a deeper dive into the next versions of C Sharp and Visual Basic and Roslyn, and I think he's actually going to build that extension for you as part of his session. So you can see how kind of straightforward and approachable that really is. Let me show you one more thing here. Let's go over to this machine. The last thing I'll just show you, just kind of one of the other reasons we get excited about kind of what can be done with this compiler technology. If I go in and do something outside of the development environment, so let's say I want to go look up, say I'm going to work with an array list, right? I'm going to go to Bing and look it up and say, okay, Bing's got some decent stuff for me there. I can drill in. I can see, you know, the usual MSDN documentation that is, it is what it is, right? But what if right from here I could go look at the reference source and actually see the ArrayList implementation as part that is there and actually use the source itself to help as a documentation experience. This is an experience, again, outside of the IDE, powered by the Roslyn compiler technology. So you see we're getting colorization and those kinds of things. But we also then are able to go and look at each of these things. And if I want to see what the iList interface looks like, I can just navigate right to it from within the browser based on the kind of parsing and semantic knowledge that the Roslyn compiler has surfaced up running outside of the IDE. So this is just something to give you a sense of sort of the things we can do here and why we're kind of excited about this. Lots of obvious things that we could do going forward. All right, let's switch back to PowerPoint. I'm going to skip this demo. Another thing that you can do is we've used Roslyn to surface enhanced debugging information. So when you're going and moving between breakpoints in Visual Studio, we can do little debugger tips next to it that tell you how long code actually executed between those breakpoints. Not how long you took to go from breakpoint to breakpoint with all of your pausing, but the actual execution time just shows up as a little hover tip. So with that, definitely, I hope this was interesting. I hope this is a good sort of insight into some of the things we're working on. Again, lots of ways to get in contact with us. Lots of additional talks. I just picked out a few, many of them from my team that are going on this week, specifically related to development of .NET. So again, definitely encourage you to check out the future of C# and Visual Basic that Kevin will be doing. .NET in the server, that is that future, that is that ASP.NET vNext talk I mentioned and referenced, and lots more. Of course, lots of Azure talks and all those kinds of things. I will be down in the booth area on and off this afternoon if you want to see me, and I'll try to be down there a bit tomorrow as well. Definitely, follow up if you have any questions or use those other links. Yeah. Yeah, this is the one I'm supposed to hit. Definitely let us know what you thought. I thought you guys were an amazing audience for 8:30 in the morning, so you're going to get a great evaluation from me, just saying. No, seriously, I appreciate your time. I hope it was useful. Enjoy the rest of your tech ed.